From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Emma Thompson was going to star in one of Skydance Media's first animated films until the company hired disgraced Pixar executive John Lasseter. Then, on her first major label release in 30 years, R&B legend Betty LaVette reinterprets Bob Dylan. Only the first time she met Dylan, he walked right past her.
I was so angry at that point. I said, "Hey, Robert Dylan." And he turned around and looked at me, and his bass player, I could see him mouth, "That's Betty LaVette."
And a Dutch singer-songwriter on performing for American audiences for the first time. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. When David Ellison hired Pixar co-founder John Lasseter in January to head Ellison's new Skydance animation studio, the response was swift. Organizations such as Time's Up and Women in Animation condemned the decision, and many Skydance employees were furious. Pixar and Disney forced Lasseter out of his job as its chief creative officer last June, and that was after female employees alleged Lasseter had groped them and created a frat house-like work environment where women were excluded. When Lasseter came to Skydance, the studio was in production on a movie called Luck, and among its voice actors was Emma Thompson. But Thompson left the project soon after Lasseter's hiring, and she detailed her reasons in a letter to Skydance that was published today in the LA Times. Mary McNamara is a culture columnist and critic at the paper. She wrote the story about Thompson's letter, and she explained how the head of Skydance addressed concerns about Lasseter's hiring back in January.
David Ellison sent a really long, and it was a little like defiant email, basically saying, "We've talked to John and he understands that some things that he has done in the past were not appropriate. He has, you know, been addressing those issues, and it is in his contract that he must behave professionally. So nobody should be worried." I mean, the absurdity of like someone being hired at this level of, oversight, overseeing this huge staff for, I'm sure a lot of money, and having to, his boss having to point out that he is contractually obligated to behave professionally is just, I mean, my hair just like went on fire. It's like they don't understand that this isn't just about the specific instances that women have detailed, which are bad enough. I'm not saying in any way, but it's about creating an atmosphere in which women were shut out. And just the fact that he would get a job again so quickly basically sends a message to everyone in Hollywood, which is like, this is not a big deal. You know, it's a blip in the road.
So when he comes to Skydance Animation, the studio is already in development or production on a movie called Luck. And one of the voice actors in this film is an actress by the name of Emma Thompson. And Emma Thompson recently decides that she wants no part in this movie. So what does Emma Thompson decide that she's going to do and how she's going to make her decision?
Well, my understanding is that as soon as Lasseter was hired, Emma Thompson contacted her representatives and started talking about, "I got to get out of this film." And that she did indeed leave on January 20th. She withdrew from the film. And then she sent a letter to Skydance explaining why she had withdrawn from the film and asking all the questions that people had been asking, which is like, how, you know, why was the staff? I mean, one of the things that after Lasseter's hiring, and I don't know if you heard from people at Skydance, but I did off the record, people were very upset. Women and men were upset. They didn't want to have to deal with this. They didn't know what it said about their company. And so that was one of the questions she raised. It's like, well, why is John Lasseter getting a second chance when no one who's going to be working for him was asked if they wanted to give him a second chance? And she, you know, and she just lists a long number of questions that his hiring had raised and finally said, you know, she wanted to make this movie. She wanted to work with the director, but she just couldn't in good conscience lend her name to it.
So she writes a letter that she shares with the LA Times and you publish. And I think this letter will go on to be the Magna Carta or the Declaration of Independence of the Me Too movement. And here's what she writes in one passage that I'm going to quote. "Skydance employees who don't want to give him, John Lasseter, a second chance, have to stay and be uncomfortable or lose their jobs. Shouldn't it be John Lasseter who has to lose his job if the employees don't want to give him a second chance?" There's lots to single out in this. I think that's remarkable. What did you also notice about what Emma Thompson had to say?
Well, I just thought the fact that she said that people like me have to take this stand, and if we don't, nothing is going to change. We can talk about it. We can have task force. We can have PSAs, and we should do all that. But Hollywood runs on money and star power, and until the stars that make the money, the stars that make the projects run, until they're willing to go, I'm not going to do this. You know, I will not work for this man because I believe that this was not a good hire. I believe that this makes too many people uncomfortable, that it's too dangerous for too many people. You know, David Ellison isn't taking a chance. John Lasseter's not going to sexually harass him. But who knows, you know, and who's going to be the first person? Like, you know, everybody's on eggshells anyway. Like, who's going to be the person that if something happens at Skydance, who's going to speak up? Because it's the women who are targeted. They're not equal to the power of the men. That's the whole point. They're people who don't feel like they have the kind of voice. Now, I think that that has changed a little bit. I hope it's changed a lot. And I think that seeing someone like Emma Thompson take this kind of stand and walk away from a project that she was excited about doing sends a really great message to everyone, including her peers. This is another tool in terms of fixing Hollywood, is that the people who are in these positions, these A-list people, you know, need to do more than make statements. They need to make statements with their feet.
So what happens to a project like Luck? Will somebody else come in and take it over, or will the movie fall apart and a lot of people who were going to work lose their jobs? I mean, there's no real easy ending to this story, is there?
No, and that's something that she also addresses in the letter. Stars do have that kind of responsibility for a project, that they're, you know, they are one person, but there is cast and crew and people who maybe this is their first big job, and nobody wants to take that away from people. And so I'm sure it was a difficult decision, because I don't know. They haven't announced a replacement. I don't know what female actor would step in to do that. You know, I don't know what their choices are going to be. I don't know what, how the director, they've been very quiet. Nobody has been commenting. I don't know how the director feels about it. But this was a very big deal for them. This was one of two big animation films that were going to sort of put Skydance Animation on the map. And this is not a good way to start.
Mary McNamara is a culture columnist and critic at the LA Times. Mary, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Sure, my pleasure.
Coming up on The Frame, R&B veteran Betty LaVette finds the soul in Bob Dylan's songbook. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Betty LaVette released her first recording in 1962, the very same year that Bob Dylan's debut album came out. After a long stop-and-start career, the veteran R&B singer has been on a roll. She's released 8 albums since 2003. Her most recent, Things Have Changed, is composed entirely of Bob Dylan covers, creatively reinterpreted by LaVette. The song you're hearing now is Mama, You've Been On My Mind.
Perhaps it's the color of the sun-cut flat, hurrying the crossroads where I'm standing.
But as for the other covers on Things Have Changed, only true Dylanites will recognize some of the more obscure selections taken from one of Dylan's quieter periods between 1979 and 1989. LaVette's producer on the album was Steve Jordan. He played drums on Dylan's 1988 album, Down in the Groove. When LaVette recently visited our studio, she began by telling me how she navigated Dylan's sometimes inscrutable lyrics.
You'd be surprised how many people have spent millions of dollars on him and they have no idea what he's talking about. So I wanted to make the lyrics clearer, and then I had to understand them for myself. I wasn't going to do something and say, I have the faintest notion what that means, because I don't know how to feel about it if I don't know what it means. So there were some, like the tune Mama, You've Been On My Mind. We're talking about two different things. But when I read the lyrics, they meant something completely different to me. He was talking about a woman that he either, I always told the audience, either went to bed with and couldn't forget, or wanted to go to bed with and didn't and couldn't forget. But I was talking about my mama. And I was such a horrible teenager. The lyrics just lent themselves to my growing up. And so it each one of them kind of meant some of the things I knew what he meant and what he wanted you to know, and some of the things we shared the same meaning on.
When you were performing these songs in a club, you've been doing some very intimate shows, and people who think they know these songs and people who think they know what they mean and how they should be performed hear your interpretations of them. What is the most gratifying thing that you hear from them about a new understanding of the song that they're hearing?
That they appreciated the understanding, that they didn't reject it. Oftentimes, I mean, I'm sure you yourself have heard tunes that you loved forever and somebody else did them. You say, oh, wow, that was just awful. And I was expecting to get a lot of that because his fan base is more or less like a little church. At times, I felt that I was going to be like Martin Luther trying to get the Catholics to leave the Catholic church.
You call it church. Some people would call it a cult. You got to follow closely.
But I really thought that they would approach me that way. But I've met absolutely no rejection whatsoever. I tried to sing the songs well, and I tried to get lyrics out that and put emphasis on them where he is so emotionless. He may be writing about the most dire thing. Very perfect, good example is It Ain't Me, Babe. We recorded it, and we were going home, and went home, and I listened to it. And we came back the next day, and I told Steve Jordan, the producer, I said, here, hold my hand, and they put it on. And I said, here, skip with me. And he said, skip. And I said, yes, skip. You can skip to this. And he's telling someone to go and jump off of a ledge. So I said, I'm going to have to approach this differently. And that's the only one that I did twice. But what I thought about was the only way probably I would tell you to go jump off of a ledge is if I was drunk. So I immediately thought about Jimmy Reed. There in came gone on away from my window.
Let's listen to a little bit of It Ain't Me.
A love of fire. A love of fire, life and more. But it ain't me, baby. No, 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 no. It ain't me, baby. It ain't me, baby.
You do it almost as if it's an R&B ballad, and I think it really kind of changes the way the lyrics land. It just becomes a different song.
Well, I'm an R&B singer. But here again, they're just songs, and you sing them the way you sing them. And it was certainly easier for me to sound like Betty LeVette than sound like Bob Dylan. I just sing them the way they feel right to me. When we did Times Are Changing, I told Steve Jordan and Larry Campbell, I said, the main thing I don't want to think about is the record. So anything that you can do to take me another way. So I sung it a cappella for them. I sung all of them a cappella for them, and then I sung them with just the piano so that they could build me an arrangement around the way I was singing it.
How important do you think music that can be used as a protest song is? Because it seems as if some current artists and some older artists, what they're saying about the world we live in today is really getting people to think clearly about their role in the world and their role in change. I'm wondering if you think, Dylan, your music kind of fits into how people can come together and get something done.
I think that Dylan's did, but I try very hard not to make my music political. If you talk to me, I'm political enough, so I can just keep the music pure. But I think that during the time that Dylan did his heaviest recording, I mean, we were in a different kind of turmoil than we are now. I think that if I recorded something right now for political reasons, it would be much more terse than Chains Have Changed.
Times, they're changing. Said the times are changing now.
We're talking with Betty LeVette about her album, Things Have Changed. I'm going to ask you about what's happened in the music business since you came back. We have the advent of Napster, which led to streaming. The way that artists are paid, the way that labels represent them has changed fundamentally in the last dozen years or so. What part of the change is most frustrating to you? And are there some of the changes that you actually think are good for people discovering your music?
Well, therein is the dilemma with my feelings, because just the technology and the many ways to reach music now has helped me particularly, because the thing that hurt Motown early on was distribution. If you can get it to everybody, then that's what the whole thing is about, and that's what costs money. So this is the first time that this many people have heard me. I don't like the fact that people can sit at home in their basement and make recordings that sell millions of pieces. I don't know that I necessarily like this dropping in and out of the business when so many people have devoted their lives to it. But it, all in all, has been very good for me.
You have actually been cranking it out. I think you have 8 album releases since 2003.
Yeah.
That's a lot faster than a lot of
people.
That's
why this is my 5th career. And it's the only one that's worked so far.
What does that pace mean to you? And are you going to just keep doing it?
As I said, I think the way that it's going has been good for me. I don't know that it's necessarily been good for the business itself. But these little doors opened, and I was able to creep into them. I don't know that I would want to right now. This is the first time I've ever made any money. I'd like to enjoy that for a moment.
And is that because I think since the first time since 1982 in 2017, you signed with a major record label?
No. That everybody's hearing it, and more people are interested in booking me. You see, you can either become this huge thing like Bruce Springsteen, where you can work, you're known from town to town to town. Right now, still, I'm only known from city to city. The people have to come from the towns to see me. I've always wanted a what I call a Ray Charles audience, where they were young, old, black, white, Asian, what, everybody. And that's beginning to look that way. From the first 30 years, my audience was entirely almost black. Then I did Bubbling Brown Sugar with Cab Calloway. That added a few whites. Then this 5th career happened. That added some more whites. And now my audience is looking more like I want it to look.
That's amazing. So when are you and Bob Dylan going to do a duet?
You know what? Don't you start me talking about this man. I just want this man to just say my name. We were in Italy. I came off the stage, and they had my door, my dressing room door surrounded. No one could come out. Mr. Dylan's getting ready to go on the stage. And I said, well, I don't give a...
You can say damn.
Let me, that ain't what I said. Let me out of this dressing room. So when I come out of the dressing room, I'm going this way, I'm leaving. He's coming out to go on stage. We're walking like this much space apart, I guess. And I was so angry at that point. I said, hey, Robert Dylan. And he turned around and looked at me, and his bass player was with him. And his bass player, I could see him mouth, that's Betty LeVette. He came across, took my face in his hands, kissed me square on the lips, and walked on the stage. And that's our only encounter so far.
Well, let's hope that Bob Dylan listens to the album, and next time he gives you more than a
quick
pick. I
hope he's pleased with it. I'd like to hear him say he's pleased with it.
I think he would be. Betty LeVette's new album is called Things Have Changed. Betty, thanks so much for coming in.
Baby, thanks so much for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, a Dutch singer-songwriter recalls performing for U.S. audiences for her very first time. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Singer-songwriter Nana Adjoa has lived in the Netherlands for her entire life, but grew up listening to American indie acts like Elliott Smith and Beck. She writes introspective lyrics, drawing on her complex relationship with religion and her Dutch Ghanaian identity. The single off her latest EP was titled Dying of Old Age. Sounds a bit morbid, I know, but it's actually about growing closer to her Dutch grandmother. Though her songs are all in English, Adjoa's most recent tour was her first time performing for U.S. audiences.
I don't know if you have the same thing, but when you grow up, you learn like numbers with colors, where you're learning like Monday or Tuesday or 1 and 3.
3 new souls made by 2.
for me, they were like, okay, 3 was blue, like 5 was red. I don't know, but I think that somewhere that stuck. I definitely have a feeling like, okay, this song is orange or black and white. One of my friends played guitar and the other one had a drum set. So that meant that I was going to play the bass. And that actually was when I found out my mother was also a bass player. So yeah, she gave me my first bass lessons. And I don't know the title, but it was a level 42 song. She played a lot of funkadelic kind of stuff. She was really into like slapping and stuff. Yeah, so my dad, I think he moved to the Netherlands somewhere in the 80s, illegally, just to get some work. And he met my mom in Amsterdam when they were about 20. My mom was 20, he was 30 or something. And I think at that time, Amsterdam was pretty like punkish or something. Like my mom was like a kind of rebel. Also because my Dutch family is totally white, so going with this African guy was also kind of a rebellious act.
A bar, a church, a place you're finally being heard.
First we lived in Amsterdam and there were a lot of more like color people where we lived. We moved then when I was about 4. To kind of like the suburbs kind of vibe, which was more like a white neighborhood. Or there were some people of color and different cultures, but they used to call my school a black school, but there were like only a handful of color people in there. Didn't really see myself as a singer necessarily, but I was writing my own songs already and singing them, but like it was like a hidden thing I did for myself, not really for the outside world. It's funny, I only wrote one song, I think, in Dutch just to see how it works.
Hallo, ik kan geloven dat er een camera ergens hangt, dus dat je als je beneden staat ook kan.
I just grew up listening to music, which was always in English, so that's very natural for me. Yeah, so for instance, this song, the first line, like opening the box, that was the first line I wrote, and then I had to figure out what I wanted to do with this box. So that took some time. I didn't start with an idea, it's just like these chords, and then, yeah, if you just play them long enough, something comes to mind, like what you're actually feeling. And I need to kind of write something down, and then when I'm reading it again, I understand what I feel. So it's kind of like a method to understanding my emotions, I guess. Yeah, so religion is popped up at one point because my parents both got religious after they divorced, but me and my sister aren't, so it's kind of like a touchy subject sometimes. But so that brought me some new way of viewing things.
Grandma wants to say goodbye. Hasn't she found the other right? She says I don't need to be afraid.
Dying of old age, I had just written down some conversations I had with my grandmother, things I thought about when we were talking.
She lost her love long before his time, and now she wants to join him in the endless night.
She lost my grandpa, which I never met, and he was like about 60 or something. So she spent like a big part of her life alone. also she's Frisian, so that's like a small part in the northern part of the Netherlands. They also have their own language, which I don't speak. Anyway, yeah, we had some discussions about life and yeah. The difference with these US shows is that in the Netherlands, people listen to your voice, but it doesn't right away register like all the words. And here I was like really conscious of that. Everybody could understood everything I was saying. So I was like getting more into that myself also, like how do I sing this song lyrically? And yeah, so that was really a new experience to just know that everybody understands what you're saying. And it's different, really different.
That feature on Nana Ajoa was produced by The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett. That's our show for today. Remember, you can always get The Frame as a podcast. You'll find us wherever you like to listen. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.